Today we're discussing PR with Nikki Hager. Nikki is the author of Secret Power, New Zealand's Role in the International Spy Network, his first book, which first brought him to worldwide notice. He's also the author of Seeds of Distrust, the story of a GE cover-up, and Secrets and Lies, written with Bob Burton. Secrets and Lies is about business and government interests using public relations to manipulate political debate. Okay, now today we want to talk about public relations, PR as it's known. Now, a while ago, a few years ago, I saw you you turned up on Newsboy and Mikey Havoc's show and in Wellington. Can you still hear me?
Yes, I can. Yeah, okay. I can.
And you on TV, typically you don't have a lot of time, but you covered a few things. And one of the things you did is you went and stood outside a PR building and filmed the building and talked about PR. And at the time, I was sort of wondering, what's the big deal about PR? Why, you know, in this short period of time they've got on TV, why are they talking about this issue? So do you want to just give us some background on PR and tell us why it's something that we need to take notice of?
I'd be very happy to do that. PR sounds like just kind of glossy publications and people writing press releases, and sometimes it gets a more kind of snarky description as being spin doctors. What I'm talking about when I'm interested in PR is not the kind of PR people who maybe work for the local tractor-making manufacturer who put out their press releases for them, or the PR people who work for the local Institute of Technology and produce their glossy annual reports and their publications. Those are people who are helping with media work and communications. And it's a large industry. There's lots of people who are contracted in to do that kind of work. But there's a whole other area of PR, which is the stuff that doesn't get enough attention. And those are the paid people in politics who are doing PR work. And their job is to work for governments and political parties, but it's also often to work for big companies and lobby groups to help them have influence in the political system. And again, that could sound normal. If you're the anti-Kyoto coalition, you know, the people who are trying to stop measures about greenhouse gases or trying to stop New Zealand being part of the Kyoto Protocol, which, and there is such a lobby group, or if you're the oil industry lobby group, or if you're the pro-gambling lobby group, and we have all of those operating in New Zealand, you could say that they're like everyone else. They can have their say in the news, and they can let people know what their group thinks. The problem comes, and that's partly true. The pro-lobby groups should be able to, the pro-gambling groups and so on should be able to have their say if there's a public debate. The problem comes that what these PR tactics are about is that a company or one of those lobby groups can spend heaps of money and get far more influence over an issue than normal members of the public. It's kind of like they can hire, and if you're the gambling industry, or if you're a political party, or if you're a big business that's trying to push a project through somewhere, they could hire, in effect, their own little Greenpeace that puts out press releases and organises public meetings and does research and lobbies politicians. And what you find is that all it takes is heaps of money, and any interest at all can have a really significant impact on the political system. And they would say, we're not doing anything that Greenpeace doesn't do, but the point is that Greenpeace does that with 100,000 members and widespread public support, and that's why they can sometimes have an influence over what the public, over what the government does, or over an issue. What happens with these PR companies is that I could be the the lobby group that wants to stick a motorway through the middle of someone's town where none of the local people want it, just to give an extreme kind of example, where there's no support at all. And if you just spend hundreds of thousands of dollars or more on your PR company, they can manufacture a bigger campaign in favor of the motorway than all the local people put together who are opposed to it. And that's where you get into difficulties with PR. And that PR company I stood outside with, Havoc and Newsboy, a while ago, was the one which had been hired, with an American-owned company at the time, had been hired by the logging company on the West Coast to fight environmentalists who were trying to stop the cutting down of native forests. And I was explaining all the techniques that they had used on what was by then extremely unpopular cause to try to damage the environmentalist cause and to discredit them and to cause trouble for their supporters and get rid of their funding, set up fake groups on the West Coast that looked like they wanted logging to keep going. In other words, spend lots of money to try to win a political debate for their clients.
Well, can we talk about that example, because that was an example I wanted to use, something specific that people can sort of get their teeth into. What actually happened there with that issue?
Right, this is something that I wrote a book about, actually, in 1999. It was called, a book called Secrets and Lies, for obvious reasons. What happened was you'd had for a few years Forest and Bird, Native Forest Action, student environment groups, different environmental scientists, different people, quite a lot of people lobbying really hard, protesting in the forests, going to Parliament with marches, writing letters to the paper, talking about why they didn't think that that New Zealand's old native forests, which are full of rare birds and so on, should still be being cut down for profit on the West Coast, which was the last area of the country where it was happening. It's all ended now, luckily, but that was what was happening then. And on the other side, you had this really vigorous pro-logging campaign. And watching it, having read about public relations tactics in other countries, I got this really suspicious feeling that there was more to it than just the locals saying that they wanted to have their jobs or that they didn't like the greenies coming around. It felt extremely orchestrated. And so I took more than a year, I put my feelers out and tried to find somebody who was working for the logging company or in their public relations company. So they had two different companies, PR companies, working on it. And I eventually found somebody who not only briefed me on what was happening, but gave me a large pile of their internal public relations strategies. And that was what I wrote the book on, because it was such an illuminating example. And so what you had was, you had strategies which said, these are the people who we need to get on side, and this is how we can do it. We can spend money, we can sponsor these scientists in their work, we can fund these things, we can spend more money on these local community things to try and buy these people on side. And meanwhile, who do we need to neutralize, as they put it, sounding like kind of Terminators? And they name the different people who, different groups and individuals who they wanted to try to close down and shut up and not let them have their say on the thing. And so, for example, there were a whole lot of documents there where they thought that the body shop was funding Native Forest Action, who were the people protesting in the forest down there. And then this PR company, costing hundreds of dollars an hour for the PR people's time, spent weeks trying to find dirt on the body shop and contacting their overseas affiliates in the US, this US company's PR network, to try to get dirt on the body shop and heavy the body shop, saying, we'll smear your environmental record if you keep giving money to these environmentalists. And they did that. They got stuff in the papers and they heavied them.
Did it work?
No, the body shop didn't back down, fortunately. But other people did. They were, for example, one by one, they went through the different scientists or academics who were speaking out saying, we believe that this logging is damaging the forest and it's going to cause rare birds to get more rare, or whatever it was. And they went to those people's university department heads, like the dean of ecology at this place or the head of that research institute, and they put serious pressure on these people through the old boys network, through people they knew there who they could talk to, by challenging their scientific credibility and causing them problems with their employers. And it was all a very consistent strategy. The other thing they did, which blew me away when I got the proof of it, was there'd been this very vigorous West Coast group called Coast Action Network, which when it was on the radio and the TV and in the newspapers, the journalists who were being sleepy and not very conscientious about it said, West Coasters say, and a West Coast spokesperson says, you know, this is disgusting and it's going to destroy the fabric of our societies if these environmentalists get their way, and all the things they were saying. What I found was that group called Coast Action Network had been set up by the logging company and the PR people in a joint meeting. And they'd got a guy who'd never even lived on the West Coast before, who just arrived there, to be the spokesperson for it, who was just a practiced political activist who was good at his angry rhetoric. And they manufactured the whole group. And it wasn't long after they set it up that was the main group that Radio New Zealand and TV and people were quoting when they went to the West Coast to ask the West Coasters what they thought about these environmentalists and the logging. And it was a completely fake group. This group's press releases and its tactics and its funding were all coming from the logging company headquarters.
Well, is it common to have groups like that? And also, is it common for mainstream journalists to not notice that the group is a fake group or not investigate?
Yes, it is very, very common for busy, unspecialist journalists to just take what comes in the way of press releases and spokespeople. And yes, the reason why this public relations, to get back to your first question right at the beginning, why does this public relations stuff really matter, is that, you know, I exposed one case of it, which was that Timberland stuff, and it caused Timberlands a huge amount of embarrassment, and I think it actually, I would like to think, helped to mean that those forests were all in National Park now, which they are. But on most issues, most days, working away day after day, on practically every issue you can think of, there are similar lobby groups. Because if you've got millions or billions of dollars to make from your business and you don't want to be interfered with by essentially democratic processes or protest groups or whatever, it's worth spending the money on this. And so if you go through New Zealand, on pretty well every contentious issue that you have, or every potentially contentious issue, you will have an industry group or a specialized lobby group or an innocent-sounding group, which sounds like it's just a community group working on the issue, which is being paid by the industry. And that's why, for example, on a hugely important issue like climate change, all around the world, including in New Zealand, you have these groups which are saying, is there really climate change? We're not sure this is really true. And you track those groups and those scientists back, and you find almost always that they're being funded by the oil industry.
Okay, now in Secrets and Lies, you said that the PR company, they don't like surprises, and they do a lot of investigative work to prevent themselves being surprised by what activists are doing. But how did they react when you came out with your book, Secrets and Lies?
Well, fortunately, they didn't know it was coming, and I'd been a bit smart actually, because I'd been sort of steeped in their way of thinking for months while I worked on the book. And so, at the back of the book, I wrote what those PR people call a crisis management plan, because this is what they work out, crisis management plan for this happening or that happening, to prepare for it. And so I wrote it in the back of the book, in an appendix, I put a crisis management plan for them for the release of my book, like how they would handle it.
Okay.
And I said the typical tools that people like them would use would be, they would, the first thing they always do if somebody's done something really rotten or been caught out, is they try to paint themselves as the victim. That's a classic thing. So I said that they would say that this was the dirty trick against them, and I was a really bad person for doing it to them. So first of all, paint themselves as the victim, that something really horrible had been done to them, that their papers had been got, and that they were being just heavied, and they were just trying to do the best thing for the West Coast. The second thing that those kind of PR people always do when they know that they're seriously discredited is find some credible-sounding people who will come out their defence, what they call third-party endorsers. And so I said the next thing that would happen would be they would have third-party endorsers, which is also what they did when the book came out. And they generally just sort of worked their way through my PR plan when the book came out, as, I'm pleased to say, some journalists noticed at the time and put in the media, because I'd anticipated them.
Okay, and neutralize, used the word neutralizing before.
Yeah.
Obviously, they would like to neutralize you. So, I mean, how much do you have to put up with personally when this sort of thing is in the media?
Well, I think probably people who are listening to this will know about this. When pretty much whenever I or someone like me comes out with a major piece of work which is challenging one of the powerful interests in the country, the first thing you can expect is quite a lot of personal attacks. And that, so I kind of always brace myself, and my heart sinks as I get close to the day when I've got a big feature coming out or something, because people don't say, oh, well, we have to admit he has got something right here, but we don't quite agree with him on that, and yes, his facts are right, but we don't agree with his conclusions. That would be my kind of dream world, where people engage with the issues that you come out with,
yeah,
and admit things and say, okay, I can see that he caught us out on that, but what about this? What actually happens is they say, oh, this is really scurrilous, and he's just a conspiracy theorist, and you would expect that from a left-wing person like him. In other words, it's all personalized, and this is not just something to do with me. This is what you see in Parliament every day. It's sort of the way that politics are done. It's a way of avoiding dealing with issues which you mightn't actually secretly in your heart believe that the public supports you on. It's much simpler to attack everyone else. And And so that's the part of it which I find really a drag. But luckily in New Zealand, you don't get more serious things like you would in other countries, like fearing for your life or being hassled too much. It's just, you know, just calling your names.
Okay, so you must have, well, obviously, I mean, you talked about it, you've learned from the examples that the PR companies have basically given you. So you must incorporate that a little bit into how you approach things. So you must think about your own PR image, if you will.
Well, up to a point. What I try very hard to do, because I'm a person who wants to live my life and not be in the public gaze, is I just put my head down. I'm not in the news unless I've got something decent that I want to say. And I don't spend my life planning how to... because I don't need anyone to vote for me, I don't spend my life trying to promote myself or anything.
Yeah.
But yes, when it comes to putting out a piece of work, to be perfectly honest, it is true. I do partly think in the way that they would think, because I know I'm going to get dumped on. And so what do? I anticipate the ways that they will attack me, and I try to discredit my work, and I make preparations for that. I anticipate possible legal threats, and I try to do something about that. And I do that very thing, which I'm just being honest here for the sake of it, that I told you about, third-party endorsers. I try to arrange that at least a few people will come out who I know will agree with it and who will bother to support me at the time.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, if it's just left to chance, all the people who are most infuriated are the most likely ones to actually come out and say something at the time, which can feel a bit lonely.
Yeah. Mm. So, as well as for you personally, are there lessons that generally politically active people can take away from perhaps if they've read Secrets and Lies or some of your other books? What can politically active people do in terms of their own PR, and is this something you think they should be considering when they're approaching an issue?
Yep. And look, the first thing I was going to say is going to sound maybe a bit funny, but we live in a really uniquely good country for democratic politics. What I would say is, although there are nasty PR companies around who are being paid to try and subvert other people's democratic efforts and the kind of things I'm talking about, we also live in a country where a lot of the positive changes which happen result from the actions of pretty ordinary people in their community groups. So the first thing I'd say is, people shouldn't be discouraged by this. If we were living in a small state in the United States, our chance of influencing national politics would be minute, whereas in New Zealand, people really can work vigorously on an issue and make a difference on it. So the main thing I'd try to say first is that people shouldn't feel that the forces against them are so big that they can't succeed, because that's not true. We actually, you know, all around us there are people who are believing they can make a difference and proving that. What I'd say, though, after that is that people shouldn't be naive about what they're up against, that it's not just a matter of if you have your say that the politicians will take notice and do something. And in particular, there can be powerful lobby groups that once you start to look effective, will be organised against you. And what does that mean? It means, first of all, taking notice and actually finding out who your opponents are and monitoring them, because often the best way to deal with undemocratic tactics, which is like an opponent who's trying to close you down or to discredit you, is to name the game, to actually show what they're doing. And so that means, for example, if people have a very common dirty PR trick, which is a legal threat against them, this is a very common one, the best defense against that is to realize that it's a tactic. And so say there are some people like around your area who are organizing against seabed mining.
Yeah.
And they get a letter, which is a very common thing, which happens in these cases, that if you continue with what this particular action that you're doing or these statements that you're making which affect our commercial interests, you will be liable for tens of thousands of dollars of costs and we'll take you to court. This happens to people, and it's people who are in, say, a rural area or a small community are particularly vulnerable to that. The first thing to realize is that it's a tactic. It's to get information from other people who might have had it before. Ring up someone like me, ring up a group, ring up Greenpeace or another group. And what the person would learn is, from being able to tap other people's experience, is that those kind of court cases almost never go to court. They're just a scare tactic. They actually have almost no weight behind them. And the thing to do in a case like that is to find a friendly lawyer who will check that there's nothing in it, reassure you, and allow you to continue with your work. In 99 cases out of 100, to continue with your work without feeling hassled. And so that's a case where knowledge of the kind of tactics that are used, which are kind of trying to scare you and put you off tactics, knowledge of them means that you don't get intimidated and just continue with your work, and then the tactic hasn't worked. Another one I would really recommend is if people are working on an issue and they suddenly have a group spring up against them, which is the farmers group in favour of seabed mining or whatever it is,
yeah.
Or suddenly there's an iwi group which is coming out in favour of it and is making it really difficult to campaign. Now, it might be that those are genuine people who really believe in it, but often those kind of groups have been orchestrated, and so some quiet, careful inquiries and saving copies of all the press releases that come out from the opponents and writing down on a piece of paper when someone tells you, you'll never believe who's part of that group, you wouldn't expect them to be, and saving up information about your opponents like that is often enough to later come out and say, we've managed to prove that this is actually all being funded by the company and this is a complete fraud, or whatever it is, in which case the dirty trick can actually turn out to be a double-edged sword that hurts the people who are trying to hurt you. So that's another way of saying the best defense against these kind of tactics is to be aware of their existence. If you're in the middle of a vigorous campaign, get a copy of my book from the library called Secrets and Lies and find out the kind of tricks that were used on the West Coast. And knowing that, try to be aware of them, not be scared of them, and to expose them when they're happening. Name the game when these things are being thrown at you.
Sometimes I get, I'm reading that book at the moment, and sometimes I get the feeling that we're up against a great big huge monster, and it's almost impossible to defeat. But then I also noticed how the PR people were obsessing about every little thing that activists did, every little letter to the editor, and I had been thinking that, you know, a letter to the editor, it was almost a waste of time, nobody took any notice of it, but the PR people give the opposite impression to that.
It's a really interesting factor that this happens. I was having this discussion with someone on East Timor recently. A friend of mine's writing a book on about the different big powers' influences over East Timor from the invasion through to when it was an independent country. And she was saying that she'd been looking at all the internal papers that are coming out now 30 years later. And all the people who were campaigning on East Timor and freedom for the East Timor people had the sense that the protests that they held and the letters they wrote and their delegations to Parliament, that the Indonesians were just laughing them off and just saying, forget it, and ignoring them. And actually, when all the papers came out later, the diplomatic papers from different countries and their contacts with the Indonesians, they found exactly that thing, that the Indonesians were desperately sensitive about every single criticism that they got. And of course, it was just one of their tactics to act totally indifferent in the hope that would put off the people on the other side. So yeah, I'd say, I personally think writing letters to the paper is an extremely powerful and underestimated kind of political action. I also would say that I think writing letters to politicians is often especially something like a petition, can be a rather useless one sometimes. Not always, but writing letters to paper, I think, is very powerful because everyone sees it. No one can censor it. It can't just be put in someone's filing cabinet. You're really out there. So yeah, I think we're lucky. We live in a country where there's a lot of scope to create change.
So when there was the GE march in Auckland a couple of years ago, and Helen Clark said, 20,000 people. We had heaps more than that in the Vietnam days.
Yes.
That's what she's saying. But what do you think she's actually thinking?
I think, I'll tell you two things. The first thing I think is that was one of the really low points in her political career. I remember that very well because I was so mad at her. Because what she was doing was she was denigrating. She was kind of slapping down a whole lot of people's genuine, non-violent, proper democratic participation. And politicians should respect people when they bother to act democratically. So it was a really fucked. It was a terrible thing to do. But there's no doubt about it. When people act shirty like that, when people act shitty like that, which is what she was doing, it was because that was really hurting. She didn't like that going on, and that's why she was rude about it. Same reason she was rude about the people on the big hikoi, is that that means it was hurting, and people should recognize that. That doesn't mean they're being ineffective. It means that they're being very effective. And can I say a quick word on this? Because I reckon a lot of people who were involved in the GE campaign, anti-GE campaign, felt that because the moratorium was taken off, they'd lost, that all their marching and all their submissions and everything had been a failure. And that was what they were supposed to think. There was a very powerful lobby group, very effective lobby group called the Life Sciences Network,
yeah,
which is an archetypal example of these ones I'm talking about, which tried very hard to attack and denigrate and close down the anti-GE debate. So everyone who was involved in that, this is the message I think they should take from it, is that the moratorium was taken off, and New Zealand has virtually no genetic engineering going on. There are almost down to zero food companies that will have anything to do with genetic engineering. Nobody wants to release it into fields. No one's trying to put new crops out. There's a couple of tiny little marginal research projects which haven't quite been wiped out, which are a pity. But actually, what that's all showing is not that that campaign lost and the moratorium was taken off, but that campaign shifted the public opinion ground so strongly in New Zealand that those companies don't want to go there. And so I would say that was a campaign, despite the nasty comments and the put-downs and the moratorium being taken off, that was a campaign that 95% worked, which is actually a really fantastic example of how motivated people can change things, because all the predictions about genetic engineering coming into New Zealand, they're not happening because no one wants to do it because they were so successful.
Yeah, yeah. Now, just on that issue, there was the whole, what they called, Corngate controversy, which was sparked again by a book.
Oh, what was that about?
About the corn game.
I'm only joking.
Sorry. I'm always worried about technical issues with community radio.
Yeah.
So I just want to talk about what happened after that. I mean, one of the first things was that Helen Clark actually came out with a grand conspiracy theory that you and TV3 and the Green Party were conspiring to defraud her election chances and all this sort of thing. And a lot of the media kind of went along with that. So can you talk about the aftermath of that, what happened to that, and the sort of attack that went on to John Campbell as well as you?
You have to say it was one of the least pleasant experiences of my life with that counterattack, because it was pretty successful and it really hurt. Remember I said that there are classic techniques for managing a crisis which you will see politicians and PR companies use over and over again, and they do it, it's become so natural that they wouldn't even be ticking off a list. It's just the way they think about how to handle something. The first tactic that tricky political people will always use when they're in hot water and in trouble is they will try to paint themselves as the victim. They will try to find some way to make it look, to deflect things around to they're the one who has been wronged, even when if the subject is demonstrably about something less than worthy that they've done themselves. And so what Helen Clark did was she turned this issue around very very cunningly, cleverly, into a variety of things that were attacking her. The first one that she tried was that this was the Green Party being attacking her in a scurrilous way. And she said, never in all my time in politics have I seen such a scurrilous gutter attack from another party, which had this small hidden assumption that I was somehow an agent of the Green Party, or that the Green Party even knew I was doing the book, neither of which were true. But it was an exceptionally good diversion of the issues which the book was about and what it said about her government. And so it was a very clever one of painting herself as the victim. And I spent a lot of the next few days answering questions about my association with the Green Party rather than answering questions about what was in the book. In other words, it served as a very good diversion because people weren't talking about the book, which was the purpose. The other really major diversion that she came up with was to attack John Campbell, which of course has nothing to do with what the issue was about or the book was about or the things that were being raised or what had been said about her. It was about his interview style. Had he interviewed her in an unfair way? Which is a minor issue, but it was not the issue, what the issue was about. It was nothing to do with the issues of corn and things. But I think there are more people who will remember Helen Clark was mad at John Campbell and called him a little creep than have any idea what was in my book. And Helen Clark was painting herself as the victim. It eventually went to the Broadcasting Standards Authority, who brought out a result saying John Campbell did not do something wrong by ambushing her, you know, and so her main allegations against him came to nothing.
I think even using the word ambush there as an example of how it stuck, I thought it was just a normal interview.
Well, it was a really heavy interview because she got so shirty with him. It was pretty painful to watch, I thought. But going back, I've looked at it since then, he was just pushing her on something where she didn't want to talk about it before she had worked out all her spin lines. However, having said that, the main thing I'm saying is that it was a tremendous diversion off the issues in the book, which, to my disappointment, because actually it got lost in all those diversions, I think I had it pretty well exactly right, and it did raise issues which are ones that the Labor government should have thought about itself, because it's now common knowledge that people are distrustful of them in different ways or cynical about how they operate and their secrecy and their spin doctoring and things. That's all kind of... No one questions that these days,
The thing I got from reading that was that Helen Clark turned immediately to PR people to solve the problem. I almost felt like she'd sold her soul to the devil or something. It was kind of on that level.
Oh, you see, I have this... That's what the book was about, but I have a slightly more sympathetic view of it than that view, believe it or not. And that is that I think it's really hard to be a politician. And it's really hard to be a politician who, including Helen Clark, at least some of the time, wants to do principled things, because you've got this huge, organized, lobbying, media force against you, which dumps on you, even when it's not fair to dump on you. And so what I think, and in her case, she's got a completely cranky, dysfunctional party called the Labour Party, which has got people who should be in the ACT Party and all kinds of weird people inside it. And so what I think has happened with her is that as she has fought her way to power, she's lost the plot in a way. That's the tragedy of Helen Clark, in my view, is that she has realised that the only way she gets there is by being a controlling control freak, extremely expedient manager, and she just has to manage everything. And managing is a very different thing than leading and inspiring and doing what you believe in and trying to take the public with you. It's all about, you know, playing the game right at every moment to survive and to get your way politically. And it's what turns people off politics, because people know when they're just getting spun and there's manipulation and the words are all being carefully chosen to evade problems and to look good. But that's what she's learned to do. And so, yeah, that's what that book was about, the way that expediency and managing the different interests that were going on and trying to avoid political problems overwhelmed other issues like playing it straight, sticking to the law, you know, including the public and things, treating the public with respect, those other kind of democratic issues all got lost in the pragmatism.
Now, you talk there about how Helen Clark was quite idealistic but found that in politics she had to, as you say, be a control freak and manage everything.
Yeah.
Isn't that how politics kind of works? That's what it does to people who are idealistic. It seems to happen to everyone who gets into politics. And in terms of getting into political party politics, not talking about being an activist on the outside.
Yeah. I don't think it happens to everybody. My view on politics is that a lot of people go into politics who shouldn't be there anyway, and they go into politics because they want to be a politician.
Yeah.
And it's probably, maybe they were teased at school or they had trouble with their families or they got this need in them to be an important person. And people who want to be politicians and don't really have a very strong rudder in terms of what they believe in are soon just caught up in the game, and you see that all the time. But I'm talking about a different kind, which is there are also people who go into politics, like people who go into the police force for idealistic reasons, whatever it is, people who want to make a good difference to their country. And I think some of those people survive and some of them don't. I think there are people in politics. I mean, this is trying not to be too cynical. There are people in Parliament right now who are really doing their best on things. Some of them are in the cabinet, some of them are in national you know, they're through the you know, some of them, the Greens and other parties, who are really, they're not there because they want people to recognise them in the streets. They're actually putting up with a pretty foul life of being a politician, because unless you're an egotistical maniac, that you work really hard and you're involved in all sorts of grotty stuff just to sort of get through each year. And I think there are people there who are really doing their best for the country, but it's damn hard to do it. And what I'm saying is Helen Clark's an example of where the survival and the finding ways to get ahead has kind of swamped the point of it, where she's had to put so much energy into the holding her ground and managing her mad party that the whole point of being there kind of gets lost on the way, or it does to a lot of it gets lost, and she ends up doing things which the old her would have thought were despicable. There are other people in there who have an aim so high and who put up with not being as powerful, not clawing their way as high, who do year after year try to do good stuff, and they do good stuff in their electorates, and they do hundreds of invisible things helping people who are having being done and, you know, being badly treated by the bureaucracy or something, or who work on particular issues of their own that they make progress on, which aren't really big issues but which help the country. But and so it really doesn't pay to be too cynical about politicians, because some of them do try, and it's a really horrible job. You know, you wouldn't want to, not many people actually want to go there and have that bad experience.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk now about someone who was perceived as a different type of politician, I think. And this also comes back to how you conduct yourself and present yourself, which is kind of the personal PR angle, which is about the late Rod Donald,
yeah.
Yeah. I know, and people who are in the activist community often critical of the Green Party and Rod Donald for being a little bit soft, or appearing to have sold out, or not telling it like it is. Well, this is what some people say, and I have my personal feeling is that that's not necessarily true. I'm wondering if he was just playing the game the way it needed to be played for someone in his position, which is in Parliament. He's got to get 5% of the vote. Is that your feeling as well?
Yeah, I'm not just saying because he's died. I reckon that Rod, there were things there are things that on all of us that you can criticise that we didn't do well enough.
Yeah,
and when you're actually in there, as opposed to on the sidelines criticising, you have to make all these calls, these really difficult calls. And I can think of things, I can't actually right now, but I could think of things where I thought he hadn't made the right call. You know, political, do we back this thing to trade off for that thing and so on, where maybe he made the wrong decision. But the thing that was outstanding about Rod, and which he had to die for lots of people who actually pause and think about it, was that he had stuck at promoting principled progressive causes, including unpopular principled progressive causes, since he was a teenager, and had never stopped. And now that's a really rare and admirable thing. And if sometimes people thought that he wasn't fighting on every issue at once, that was unreasonable expectations. That one person, he actually, because I saw him, I used to think, in fact, he worked on too many. My main criticism of him, from a political point of view, was that he tried to do too many issues, that he had a scattergun approach, and he tried to do a little bit on too many things, which actually reduces your effectiveness. But he had a strong belief in that someone like him should be supporting movements and other people's efforts. And so he tried to do a little bit on everything that he possibly could to support other people. But no, do I think he was going soft on things? No, I don't. I think maybe that's that terrible disease of politics, where it's really easy to criticize people without thinking about the position that they're in.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking of an example here of someone who's a peak oil activist who was, you know, why is Rod dealing with any other issues? They should be dealing with peak oil, and why doesn't he turn every opportunity into a peak oil opportunity? That was kind of the angle that this person was coming from.
And that makes sense to you when you're working on a single issue.
Yep.
And if you sat in Rod Donald's office, you'd find that after that person walked out explaining why he has to work on that, a group would arrive in from Child Poverty Action. And it would be equally obvious that you can't just ignore that. that, you know, that one can't drift by for a few more years while everyone does peak oil first. And then someone would come in straight after that and say, well, I hope you realize that there's no point in working on any of these things if you don't work on, you know, our trade agreements with other countries, because otherwise we've got no power to do anything on any of these issues. And if you don't worry about what we're doing in the WTO, you may as well forget about national policies on poverty and peak oil and stuff. And then the person who comes in after that would say, well, yeah, you can talk about all those issues, but if we don't deal with electoral reform issues and this thing here, you won't be able to make any decisions on any of it anyway. And so on, and suddenly you'd realize that there's always lots of things that can be called the most important issue. And we all do the best we can, and Rod did more than most, so he's a really bad example of someone to criticize on that.
Yeah, yeah. Now, just I know that the media loves to get footage of activists being shouting and screaming and you know, being behaving like extremists, which is kind of the popular view. Rod, I don't remember ever seeing Rod doing that, and he's in the media a lot, which means he must have been very aware of that issue, must have been quite disciplined about how he appeared. He always appeared reasonable and calm.
Yeah, no, I think he was absolutely dead right. I hope there are some people listening who think about this, because my view, his view I'm sure was, and my one I share, is that when you go out in public, you're not representing yourself, and you're not representing yourself and your mates who you talked about it with, you know, the night before. You're representing thousands or hundreds of thousands of people who have the same values as you and care about the issue. And if you're representing them, you actually, the way you represent them is not looking like you're a nutty fringe who only five people support, and an angry nutty fringe which tends to alienate people. You want to speak with a voice where all those tens or hundreds of thousands of people who have that view think, yes, that person's speaking for me. And I think that's often I see people who are looking really angry or thinking that they have to get arrested to get in the news. And I'm sorry, because in most cases that means that those tens or hundreds of thousands of people think, oh, that's some kind of weird protester. I don't feel comfortable with that. They're not really speaking for me. And worst of all, the politicians or the opposition on that issue will be thinking, that's just cool with me. I really like it when my opponents look unreasonable, because they're not going to change very much.
Yeah. Okay, now, at a more personal level, and this is something I'm always interested to ask people, is what motivates you to do this? I mean, this is basically your job now. What has motivated you to turn your life around this way?
I've been doing this stuff pretty well all my life, one way or another. I don't think any of us know, to tell you the truth. I don't think anyone really knows why they do what they do. But I'll add a couple of thoughts. I mean, first of all, I was lucky enough to grow up in a family that talked about politics. And sometimes, what you find is that people who are involved in politics, this is my theory, aren't some special, caring, principled people. I don't think it's like that at all, actually. I think it's just chances of life means that you flattered with someone, or you knew something, or something happened that gave you an experience which allowed you to discover your political self. And this, you know, if I'd grown up in a different family and different circumstances, I'd probably, my social concerns might be being put into a sports club or trying to be a really decent person at the place where I work or something. So I think it's a rather random thing that brings people into politics. But the other thing I think, which is really important, which I often think about, is that I know one of the things that can't help but keep me going, and that is that I've had experiences which have showed me what an influence I can have. And I contrast this. I sometimes see people in there in a small group and they're campaigning away about something without much support and maybe not really knowing what they're doing very well. And they don't get very much sense of their own power. In other words, they might just be getting a sense of their kind of nothing seems to really be working and no one's taking any notice of us. And those experiences don't encourage you to keep being politically active. That's what I'm saying. They don't really, they don't make you think when you see an issue, yes, I have to do something because I know I can help on that. What I've had is since I was at university, I've been involved in different ways in politics and seen myself and other people, ordinary old people who just got into it one way or another, being able to have a really huge effect. And once you've done that once, for me it was started off in puppet movements to do with the nuclear free policy in the 1970s. And I saw that that ragbag of people I worked with were able to lead the country a long way down the road to what's now a huge change in nuclear free policy and national identity, which was opposed by the most powerful country in the world and by a lot of the establishment, and yet we still succeeded. And once you've had that experience that it's actually, you're up against powerful forces, but they don't always win, and that organized people can do something, it's a completely life-changing experience, because next time you see something which offends you and the political part of you as a person feels enraged or inspired and wants to do something, you don't have this other wave of feelings following it saying, but I can't do it, it'll never work. You think, I know that if I pull my finger out, I can probably make a difference on this. And at least in my case, and I've seen with lots of my mates, that feeling just keeps coming back right through your life.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'll ask you one more question now, which is perhaps some advice for people listening. How can the average person detect PR, particularly in the news? How can they be aware of it, and how can they avoid it even?
Well, I'd say that one of the main things is, and I say this to myself as a constant reminder, there is practically nothing in the news which hasn't been organized to be there that day. When the government announces something, when the opposition releases something, when a report comes out saying such and such, or a poll comes out, somebody has organized that, they've had a motive, they've had a reason for doing it that day rather than another day. They've probably could have spent a lot of money on arranging the things that they've carefully prepared with some of their mates to come out and support them. Most of what happens in the news, I don't mean car crashes, but I mean political events, has been organized by somebody. If you work from the premise that most of what you see is there for a reason and it has been organized by somebody, that's a good starting point, because you can say, why did that happen today? Why did they put it that way? What am I not being told? Who is behind this thing? This hasn't just come from nowhere. There must be somebody who organized that. Who is it? What are their interests? If you start to look at the news not as the final and finished truth, but a sign of the political activity of different people in the country, it sets you up for a much clearer idea of what's going on.
Yeah. Okay, Nicky, well, that's great. Thanks heaps for your time, and hopefully we can talk to you again in the future about other issues.
Yep, good luck with the station.